Yes, what's the question?
Yesterday,
Yeah.
You explained how deterministic operators can be used to describe the wave function without actually using the wave function, because if you have a set of deterministic operators, then you basically can infer that wave function, which corresponds to it.
Yeah.
And I was wondering whether it's possible to use the statistics of those deterministic variables or operators to infer statistics of other operators, which are not deterministic operators.
Well, the answer, the indirect answer is the following. If you know all deterministic operators, you can find out a vector in Hilbert space. If you have a vector in Hilbert space, then you can express it in any complete set of eigenvectors. And because our measurements are always depend on your local interactions, we do the expansion in position representation. And that then gives us information of statistics, because when you go to an ensemble, then you can show that like I started to do, to show that all the properties of the ensemble can be observed even if you do experiments that don't change the systems at all. So that is the route, the indirect route that you can do it. Let me continue perhaps with some more remarks about it, and then maybe at the end if you can ask me more questions. Are you okay?
Yes.
Oh, good. That's an interesting way to observe it. Okay. Now, I was wondering if we saw a collapse of the wave function. Okay, any other questions? All right. So, at the end of last talk, I have shown the important theorem that if you have an ensemble of particles, sufficiently large ensemble, all of them described by the same state, then you can find new kinds of measurements, very many of them, in fact, that don't disturb even a single particle. And the way you do it, you take any individual operator for a single particle, sum all of them, divided by the total number, and then you show that this thing can be measured without disturbing even a single particle when the limit when n goes to infinity. And you can find out all the properties, all the individual properties, because if you know the average of any individual particle, you know what the state is. I want now to generalize it in a trivial way and to show you then that these kinds of weak measurements are very, very common. In fact, they are the way to define the macroscopic or classical limit. But first, let me show you the generalization. Suppose the ensemble I'm talking now is an ensemble made out of many individual systems, but they are not described by the same state. Namely, I have now a situation where each independent particle can also be described by a different state. As long as these identical products and not many large entanglements, then I can write the thing as a product of individual different states. And then ask what happens when I measure this operator on this system. And it turns out that I still get a definite value, and the definite value is a total average, where a total average is defined as the sum of the individual averages divided by n. So for each different particle, I have another so-called average, but now it's a property just of a single particle, and I make an average of those averages, and this will be an eigenstate, or this will be the exact value I will get in this measurement. This is trivial to prove it. Let me prove it to you. It's practically the same proof that I've given before, but I will repeat the other proof with a slight modification. If I have a sum of a n divided by n operating on an ensemble and goes from one to large n. But now this ensemble is a product, is a physical ensemble, which is a product of different individual states. So each individual particle may have a different state. Why is this important? Before I prove the mathematics, if I look at any macroscopic object, like this table, for example, it, after all, is made with a huge number of quantum particles, namely atoms. Each one, so I can think about this table as a physical ensemble of all these atoms. Each one of them is described by slightly different state. And when a photon, for example, comes and hits this table and comes to my eye, the photon has large extension, so in fact, it does a weak measurement or weak interaction with any one of these atoms, and what it will show is the average of all these atoms. Each atom, for example, has a state that is spread over something of the order of 10 to the minus 8 centimeter in every direction. Each atom has a wave function, the proton has a wave function, the electron has a wave function. They have an average, so each one of them has its own average. And I'm saying that what this photon will see will be the average of the average. And that, for example, when you have a laser, and the laser hits a mirror, each photon sees is the average position of all the atoms in this mirror, which can be defined much, much better than the uncertainty of each one of the atoms, because you take the sum of the averages divided by n. That's why you can define the position of this mirror that the photon sees to a much, much better accuracy in 10 to the minus 8. It can be 10 to the minus 12, then minus 15. This is relevant, for example, for the LIGO experiment, this kind of phenomena. So that's why it's so important. I'm saying that weak measurement of this type of ensemble is the most common thing that happens, because any interaction in the macroscopic domain in classical physics is always an interaction of this type. Each atom, if I have a collision between my hand and this, each atom of my hand does a weak measurement on many atoms here, and I get the whole feeling that my hand feels is average of average, like this. And it doesn't disturb any of the atoms. That's why it's classical physics. So this is extremely important theorem to understand. So let me prove that theorem. It's practically the same proof that I had before with slight modification. If I now look at what happens when I take a particular AM and act on the ensemble. So AM acts only on psi m. And what does it do to psi m? When I remind you the beautiful theorem that AM times psi m is equal to A average for this state. The average of this operator for this state, by the way, I can even, as I said, I can take different operators here and different vectors here, and the whole thing works, okay? So AM, x on psi m, give me the average of AM for this state, the average of AM for this state, times the same state, plus an uncertainty of AM times some orthogonal state to M, right? Okay? And that's everything that I need, because now when I sum all of them, I will get here the same ensemble as before, but the sum of all the averages divided by n, so it's average of averages. And this again will go to zero, because these are orthogonal states to each other. I divide by n, I take the square of this, I get zero, just as I proved before. So this is a general theorem. Once I have a large collection of quantum particles, and have interaction between two systems that each has a large collection of quantum particles, as long as the interaction between any individual one is extremely weak, I get a situation that this interaction behaves as if it's a classical system. Doesn't disturb at all the system, and you see just classical physics. So this is the correct way to think of the limit to classical physics, not it can go to something that is very heavy, and because of that, the uncertainty between position and velocity goes to zero because it's divided by m. That is not the correct limit. The correct limit is to say that in classical physics, you are talking about objects that has huge number of quantum systems, and you always measure the quantum systems in this way. So that's the proper way to define classical limit, and you see that weak measurements are extremely important to understand from this point of view, okay? Any questions about that? It's sufficiently important that I will rest for a minute and let you ask me questions. Yes, Tando.
So you took here the state to be a product state.
That's right.
Of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I presume that for a real object, they mm-hmm. are actually quite entangled.
Yeah, but there could be, as
I
long as
that one can probably have a generalization.
Yeah, now the only situation where you don't have a generalization is when you do the stupid manual. Because in the stupid manual, you say, I have the whole microscopic object goes one way, the microscopic object was here, or another way. So that's a superposition of many, many particles pointing like this, plus many particles pointing like this. This is what's called cross-cut state. That superposition doesn't survive that thing. Because when you make this average, it will pick up either that or that. It will collapse it. But as long as you have only a few percentage of entanglement inside, it will not make a difference. You will just get a different kind of average. The only thing that we avoid is you don't have to have this classical system to be in true superposition of different locations, of different. Then this kind of measurement will pick either one value or another value, and therefore it will collapse. Because the average of the average will be different from this state, macroscopic state, to this macroscopic. So this will be a collapse. This kind of measurement then will collapse the system. Or, well, I mean, collapse in the usual sense. But that theorem that you get an eigenvalue here is only when you don't have a macroscopic entanglement of this kind. Because then you will have two different values. Suppose if I have n spin pointing this direction, I will get one value. If all of them pointing this direction, we get a different value. Therefore, this theorem is not true anymore that I get just one value when I apply the operator to the ensemble. So I guess you have to define the proper situation, classic situation, by saying that if you have entanglement, the fraction of particles that are entangled are extremely small compared to the total number, and then you can take each fraction like that and consider it as a single, more complicated quantum system of more degrees of freedom. But let's discuss it more carefully later, okay? There are some interesting questions.
I think that there are some subtleties.
There are some subtleties, but they can be overcome. Okay? Any other question?
You call this classical, but what is it which guarantees that these expectation values of beta class some classical equations? You haven't even mentioned those. It seems to be another ingredient must be necessary.
No. You can show them. I did not say.
Statistics rather than classical dynamics.
So far, what I meant by classical by saying that when two things interact at a given time, they don't cause collapse, they don't destroy, so they give you a definite value.
Okay.
About the dynamics, I have to show later how you generalize dynamics when you have many, many particles, but it will be done. Okay, there is another example of very, very common weak measurements. And to introduce this example, which is also extremely important, I will start with a paradox. This will be the first example when I suggest a paradox, because I love paradoxes. I think that paradoxes are the best way to teach or understand physics. In fact, I have a whole book that's called Quantum Paradoxes, and I can objectively tell you that it's a worthwhile book to read, okay? So here is a paradox. Or maybe talking about paradoxes, I will tell you that I define three types of paradoxes. The first type is paradoxes that when you solve them, you find out the reason why you thought it was a paradox was because you made a mistake a simple or not simple, but still a mistake. Like the famous thing is to divide by zero and you get the two numbers that are equal to each other. But in physics, the famous examples of paradoxes of this kind were all the attempts of Einstein, for example, and other people to find some mistakes in or some situations where the uncertainty principles are violated. You know, Einstein has two phases when he tried to attack quantum mechanics. In the first phase, he tried all the time to find some examples where he could show that the Heisenberg uncertainty principles are violated, and that means that quantum mechanics is not consistent. But these are mistakes of the first kind, because you can make a general proof that if you have any canonical formalism, and you use to describe measurement by using canonical formalism, then automatically the uncertainty relations are preserved, just like the Liouville theorem preserves it. And I can show that to you sometime later when we discuss measurement theory more carefully. So Einstein came with all kinds of examples, more and more sophisticated, and the most famous last one, after that he gave up. The most sophisticated one is a beautiful example where Einstein came up with the idea that if you have a cavity, and in the cavity you have a macroscopic clock, and this macroscopic clock at a given time can open. Here, this is the story. I have here a cavity. Here sits a macroscopic clock. And this macroscopic clock has a device that when it comes to a given time, it opens here a little door for a short time and then closes it, okay? And there is one photon that is also running back and forth in this cavity. And when the door is open, the photon can escape. And therefore, we know exactly the time when the photon left the box, because that time is controlled by the macroscopic clock. Yes?
I think you want to hang it on a spring. On a spring.
What?
I think you want to hang it on a spring.
I want to do it. I didn't finish the story. So far, I know that this macroscopic clock is going to define exactly the time when the photon left the box. Now I want to find out also the energy of the photon. So I said, oh, we all know how to measure energy. Energy is the same as mass, so let's weigh this box. So we have here some scale and something, this is a gravitational field, and you make a careful measurement before the whole thing, you make very, very careful measurement of the mass of that box. The whole thing, including the photon. You know the mass of the box, you know therefore the energy. Now, after the photon escaped, you come back and make again a very, very careful measurement of the left energy, of the mass, the new mass. The difference between the two masses, multiplied by c squared, gives you the energy that the photon came out with. Aha, I should say, look, I know the energy exactly, and I know also the time exactly. Therefore, delta E times delta T now is very small compared to h bar. From this, I can also deduce the uncertainty between momentum and position to be violated. When Einstein told this was in a Solvay meeting. Einstein told this example in the afternoon, and nobody could see a mistake at first. Nobody. And I don't remember who wrote it, but the story, that one of the people that were there, maybe Dirac or someone else, they said that Bohr's face became very long. He didn't know what to do. He said he went around and everyone told everybody, it can't be true, it can't be true. But he didn't know what to do. And Einstein was walking around with a big smile, happy. Finally, he showed that quantum mechanics is wrong. But the next morning, the role interchanged. Bohr came out with a big smile, and Einstein developed a long face. Einstein made the mistake forgetting the result of his own general relativity. Because general relativity tells you that the rate of a clock, macroscopic clock, doesn't matter, the rate of a clock depends on gravitational potential. So when you weigh the box, then when you have to weigh, you change, you have to see how until it settles, it spends time at a certain position. You can prove it. Bohr proved it. And because it has a certain position, even though the gravitational force is constant, the gravitational potential depends on the position. So if the clock spends different uncertain time at different locations, its rate becomes affected. And then finally, the time of the internal clock compared to the time of external clock becomes completely uncertain. That's enough to show the delta E delta T is safe. So this is an example of a paradox of the first kind, because that's a mistake that Einstein forgot, that you have to take into account what happened to a clock when it is in an uncertain gravitational potential. Now people say, but why do you have to use this here? Why do you have to use general relativity? The answer is that you use general relativity because you make a connection between the mass and energy, weighing the mass and energy. You can in fact find out the mass of the system not using general relativity, but sending, for example, particles to collide with it. You send the particle to collide with it, you can tell out by carefully analyzing the collision what was the mass of the box. Okay? But when you do that, it turns out now that there is some uncertain time when that collision happened, and therefore there is some uncertain some time in which you don't know if the velocity of the box was one or another. And since the rate of the clock now depends on velocity, again you get the saving grace. Now you use special relativity, namely connection between mass and energy, the special relativistic thing, and you have to use again special relativity to save the day, because special relativity also tells you that the rate of a clock, inside clock, relative to outside clock, depends on the relative velocity. So if there is a time when it moves in an uncertain velocity, that means that you develop the saving grace. So these are examples, although interesting examples, but still examples of the first kind, because after you understand it, you don't understand anything, you don't find anything that you didn't know before. Paradoxes of the second kind are paradoxes that are more interesting, because by the time you find out how to solve them, you learn something new about the theory that you didn't know before. An example of the second kind is the EPR paradox, the Einstein-Rosen paradox. It was indeed at first an attempt to show by Einstein that quantum theory is not complete. This attempt, according to Bohr, failed anyhow, although the answer of Bohr was very, very mixed up. Nobody reads the answer of Bohr, he didn't understand what it meant. But he meant, but because people believe Bohr, they said, there is no paradox. But even though there is no paradox after you claim that this follows from quantum mechanics, you have learned something new, very important about quantum mechanics, and that's the whole issue of entanglement and everything that follows from then on. So this is an example of paradox of the second kind. Paradox of the third kind is a paradox that you can't solve using the existing theory, and then you simply find that your theory is wrong and you have to change it. Example of paradox of the third kind is what happened when Rutherford found that an atom is made out of a nucleus which is positive, very concentrated, we know now it's proton, and charge that is moving around it, which are the electrons. You find out now that there is no way to explain why such an atom is stable. Because according to classical physics, if an electron is moving like a star around the sun, even though it may be moving at constant velocity, but moving in a circle, it's accelerated. Accelerated, it must radiate. It must lose energy. Every atom will collapse. We will not be alive here to talk to each other. And therefore, something is wrong with classical physics. Okay? Must be wrong, because there is no way to explain, how such a system can be stable. Okay. Now, so what I'm going to describe now, and of course all the paradoxes that I will use will be of the second kind. I don't have a paradox of the third kind, and I will not waste your time on paradoxes of the first kind. So here's an example of a paradox of the second kind that will introduce another class of weak measurements. Oh, by the way, now I take my words back. I did use one paradox when I introduced the two-vector formulation. I used the paradox of the covariant collapse. You remember what I said? Remember the paradox? I can introduce this paradox also in another way. Suppose this paradox of the second kind that we discussed last time, but I will use another version. Suppose I have an electron which has a wave function initially that is spread over a large region of space. And now I come and make a measurement and find the particle at this position. So now, if I'm in normal relativistic theory, I mean, if I use Galilean space-time, that's okay. A particle was initially here, and now it's there. There is no problem with conservation of any kind. But if I use Lorentz frame, then what happens? This is time. And here, in one Lorentz frame, the particle was spread here. And here, suddenly, the particle is concentrated. From here to here, a collapse happened. But if I go now to another Lorentz frame, for example, a Lorentz frame like that, then here the particle is spread up to this point. So there is a region of space here where in one Lorentz frame I will say there is no charge here, no probability to find here. In another Lorentz frame there is a probability to find here. So this is a paradox of the second kind. How is it possible to describe collapse and to use a Lorentzian frame of reference? And I will show to you, when we discuss more carefully later the two-vector formulation, that this is how this is being shown. Okay. Now another example of a paradox of the second kind. Which, as I said,
we are telling that there is no solution without the two-vector
formalism? No. The other solution is to believe in the many worlds. Right, that's another solution, which is not a solution. Okay, now, or to believe in Bohm. Okay, so here is the paradox. The paradox goes like this. Again, I will discuss time and one-dimensional space. And I will assume that I have a charged particle that initially is known to have a fairly well-defined momentum, so its wave function is spread over a large region of space delta x. This is the wave function time zero. Now, this particle is charged. This particle is charged. It produces electric field all over space. If I now, at some point here, open a dipole and use this dipole to measure the electric field at this location. So I'm using the target potential and say that what I measure here is the electric field produced by the particle at this time. And if I can, by this measurement, find out the size of the electric field exactly, I can find immediately where the particle was at this time. For example, I find that the particle was here at this time. So I made the collapse from definite momentum to definite position at that instant of time. On the other hand, I can affect the particle only at this time. Because when I open the dipole here, that particle will know about it only at this time. So now the paradox. Only here I reduce the position and therefore must have introduced a large momentum, but I interacted with the particle only here, so only at this time I can introduce the change in the momentum. So in the time in between, I have now a situation where according to this I know both position and velocity, and therefore there is a problem. I'm not allowed to do that. So anyone can answer that paradox, apart from people that tell me, maybe you already did this form, so you are excluded. Okay. What do you think about this paradox? How do we solve it? First of all, make sure that you understand it. You are allowed to ask also questions about the paradox itself. Maybe there is something I said that you did not understand. So, yes. He was first and then you, okay?
Yes, sorry, I apologize. I just wasn't listening properly. So maybe you could just explain.
Yeah.
You
the paradox again. Okay. I have here a charged particle. This is space. Charged particle, which initially its wave function is known to be spread coherently over a large inner of space. So that means that it has a fairly well-defined momentum. And now, I know that I can find out its position by looking at the electric field that it produces at some other point, because the electric field falls as r squared, 1 over r squared. So if, for example, I do a measurement here of the electric field, and I want to do the measurement in such a way that it, up to this interval of time, I did not introduce any disturbance at all. So I have a dipole that is closed. A dipole that's closed doesn't produce any, doesn't interact with anything.
Yes.
At this interval of time, I open the dipole a little bit,
yes,
and when I open the dipole, it can feel the gradient of the electric field,
okay,
right? And that could still give you information where the location of this particle. So I do here a measurement by opening something here, finding by retarded potential where was the particle at this instant of time, and disturbing the particle only here. Because when I open this, it doesn't... Feynman really says that you have half retarded and half advanced, right? But we believe only retarded things. So therefore, if I open the field here, the dipole here is only going to be affected to affect the particle in the future. So now I have a problem. There is a time in between that can be as long as I like by doing this measurement further away, where I know both position and velocity. Because the velocity to begin with was known. Now I find the position without yet disturbing the velocity. So for a long time, I know both position and velocity. That is no known. Quantum theory goes kaput if I'm right. Okay? So, what's going on here?
Well, two vector solution or many
ways? No. There's nothing to do with many ways. Here, people believe in many ways will be able to save the day. They could not escape this way. You wanted to ask a question? Oh, it was the same question. Any other question? You know what there is? Now there are... Oh, we still have some time?
Yep.
When did we start?
Yeah, 2:30.
No, I want to have 10 minutes intermission to let you think about it, but it's too early, so...
Oh.
It's too early. Okay. Huh? All right. Yes, you have an answer or question?
No, it's a question.
A question.
A question.
Okay.
Can you measure with that the momentum and the
position? What?
Can you determine the momentum and the position at the same time?
No. I started by knowing the momentum.
Yeah.
That I know, that was given before. That momentum is conserved, so that momentum is fixed. And I know the momentum from this thing. Now I find the position. Usually when I make a measurement of position, I must disturb the momentum. But the disturbance happens only here, so that means that there is a time in between where I could not yet disturb the momentum, and I already find out about the position. So now I have information of both of them. And that could not be true. So either we throw away quantum mechanics, or we find the right answer. But when we find the right answer, we realize that this was a paradox of the second kind, because it let us understand something that we did not know before, carefully. Well, any volunteer to save quantum mechanics?
You must spend minutes.
No idea?
But if you introduce a dipole, it should...
Say it again?
If you introduce a dipole, then you should disturb the momentum. I disturb
momentum only in the future. Because, you know, if I do something here, the particle here doesn't know about it immediately. It knows about it only much later, with the velocity of light. Right? So there is a time that the particle did not know yet that I measure it and therefore its momentum did not change it. But I, the particle in the past already affected me, so I know from what the particle did in the past, what was its position in the past, but I will disturb it only in the future. Sorry?
I mean, the uncertainty, you are saying that you have no position in the future.
But no, I know the position. I know the position in the past. I know the momentum in the past. I will disturb the momentum only in the future. But I know from this, I know the momentum from because it started with definite momentum. And as long as it's free, as long as nothing disturbs it, the momentum is known. Now I find also its position here. I didn't have a chance yet to disturb the momentum. So now the particle has both definite momentum and definite position. Okay?
But that position that you find in the past, there is uncertainty.
No, why uncertainty?
You cannot precisely find without uncertainty based on the dipole.
No, you can. If you can, and you can open a number of dipoles, there is no problem of doing that. That's not the answer. It's far away from the answer. No.
So probably consider advanced solution.
No, but you don't have to consider advanced solution.
Well, that gives me another boundary condition.
No. This is not quantum. This is not the right way. That's not the correct way to think about it.
So I don't know if this is a resolution, but I'm worried that you are treating the particle as independent of its electric field.
No, that's not the right solution also. No, it has nothing to do with radiation reaction. In a roundabout way. Okay, maybe you are beginning to touch something. Just a little bit. You are close. Yes.
What do you claim? By introducing that dipole, I think it's impossible.
You what?
It is impossible to just suddenly introduce a dipole.
Why not? Why? Why is it impossible?
I mean, you have to move it from somewhere.
No. I have already sitting here a positive and negative charge on top of each other. So when they're on top of each other, they don't, nothing knows about them. Then I come and open it. Don't worry. I mean, now it's a question of technique, how to do it. But in principle, it can be done. In principle, it can be done. So that's not the answer. Yes?
Is it that you cannot consider the field static there?
What?
Isn't it that you cannot consider the field static at the dipole?
I can't hear what you're saying.
You cannot consider the field to be static
at the dipole. Wait. Because if you evolve back the wave function of the charge backwards in time, there will be some spreading momentum.
Say it again?
The momentum, the uncertainty on the momentum of the charge will not be zero, will be small but not zero. So that wave packet cannot be static.
Why?
Completely.
Why?
Because it would have to be...
I can make this wave, this initial state very, very broad, so it's practically an instance of energy momentum. I have a lot of time that I don't have to worry about.
Only if it's infinite, that's
definitely... No, but if it's very large, you have the probability that the change that happened in the momentum, actually the momentum does not change at all. The position may change, but not the momentum. Momentum is a constant of the motion. I have a very small uncertainty of momentum, and suddenly I have to introduce a large uncertainty. Okay. I will have now a 10-minute intermission so that you all can think about it. Then I will tell you the answer. I want you to suffer a little bit.
This is perhaps the beginning of an answer. I'm not sure if it is or not.
Okay.
If you want to infer where the particle was relative to your origin of coordinates, then the dipole has to be well localized relative to your origin of coordinates.
No problem.
Okay?
Yeah.
If your dipole is well localized relative to your origin of coordinates, the uncertainty principle implies that it has an uncertain momentum.
Yeah, but
it's
not the answer because they will have a small uncertainty in the position of the dipole. It has nothing to do with the big uncertainty of the electron, and then we find the position of the electron up to that uncertainty. No answer. Yes?
So I'm actually going to put this question, but so this process with the dipole, when does it actually
It's in the wrong direction, okay? The answer is in the wrong. The answer is in the wrong direction.
Right, so yes. Maybe I can fill in what you were saying. So one thing we were thinking about is that at the location of the dipole, you have a superposition of virtual photons. So if you represent your field that way,
then of course.
You have a superposition of the virtual photons that have arrived.
Okay. No virtual photon, but it's the right direction. The point is,
how does the dipole measure? I think the main thing is just how does the dipole measure? How exactly does this dipole measure the?
No, it's much simpler, much simpler. The answer is very simple. If I have just vacuum, no electron there, just vacuum, and I open a dipole and measure the electric field, I will find zero. I will find the uncertainty of the electric field in the vacuum. There are vacuum fluctuations, and if I measure the electric field in the vacuum during a finite time, I will find uncertainties. And if the electric field that the electron produces here is small during this time, is small compared to the vacuum uncertainty during this time, I will not be able to measure it. If on the other hand, I will put here a big charge so that the electric field they produce here is bigger than the vacuum, then this poor guy feels the vacuum fluctuation here. And this vacuum fluctuation, because the charge is large, will cause for a finite time its momentum to be uncertain. And if we calculate the necessary and sufficient conditions to avoid the paradox, you find that this gives you exactly the answer what is the minimum necessary vacuum fluctuations of the electric and magnetic field. And that shows, for example, that in general relativity, you must also assume that there is vacuum fluctuation of the gravitational field, because otherwise you will run into the same paradox in the case of gravity. So some people try to say that in the case of gravity, maybe we can just look at classical situations that does not work for the same reason. So the answer is that in this way we prove that you must have vacuum fluctuations that exactly will save the uncertainty relation. Okay? And it's exactly, you calculate it carefully, you find that the minimum field, uncertain field that you need in order to avoid this paradox, here and here, you find is exactly the vacuum fluctuation. So this is a nice paradox of the second kind. It shows that we can deduce that vacuum cannot be empty. It must have fluctuation of any field that can be produced, electric, magnetic. In the case of short-range interaction, it's more complicated, but for the long-range interaction of gravitation, electromagnetic, this is a way to prove that there might be vacuum fluctuations, and exactly the size of them, if you just assume homogeneity, that you can deduce it. So, now, why did I introduce it with respect to weak measurement? Because
so,
I think...
So just to be clear, the vacuum fluctuations in the electric field...
Sorry?
How are the vacuum fluctuations in the electric field preventing you from violating the uncertainty principle? That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Is it because of the fluctuations in the vicinity of a particle?
Yeah.
Or both in the dipole? Where the dipole
in is? Both. Both of them are
both.
Necessary. Yeah. If the charge here is small, so that the vacuum fluctuation here don't affect much its momentum, then the electric field that it produces here at this distance will be small compared to the vacuum fluctuation there. So I will not be able to deduce from my measurement what was this position. But if on the other hand this charge is large, so that the electric field here will give me information about its position, then the vacuum fluctuation here makes its momentum uncertain during this period, so that I can't deduce the momentum and position there, because the momentum was uncertain during this period, because of the vacuum fluctuation there. Okay? Agreed?
Okay.
Now,
In the case of gravity, you don't have a dipole, but how do you do the argument?
Then you have tricks to do the following. You assume, first of all, that you have a region of space where you have a constant gravitational mass all over region of space, constant gravitational mass. And in this constant gravitational mass, you can now introduce variation on top of that. The variation on top of that would be to put an extra mass here and to here to remove some mass from one point to the other, and that produces relative to this constant gravitational dipole. Okay, and that's the way that you do it. Okay, now how is it connected to weak measurement? It turns out that when we have any particle, like charged particle, for example, or even a neutral particle, when we do interference experiment, suppose I do interference experiment on an electron. I send the electron this way, and I send the electron this way. I see her interference. Now I can raise the problem. What will happen if, while the electron is doing this, I make a measurement of the electric field here and find out whether the electron was moving here or here. And this way I will necessarily destroy the coherence and destroy the interference, if I can do it. Luckily, we know that it does not happen, because we know that we can do experiments with interference. That means, indeed, that the measurement, the electromagnetic field does measure the electron, but it measures it weakly. It does not disturb its state. So if, for example, I have an electron that moves this way or that way, and I make measurements here, if I do measurements on many, many, many electrons, then I can collect enough information that will give me some information about what was going here, but not on individual particles. So I know, therefore, that electromagnetic fields always measure weakly any charged particle or any massive particle. The gravitational field does it. And that's going to be very important for the next thing I'm going to tell you about. So wait for a minute, you will understand why it's so important that we have all the time these weak measurements happening all the time on any particle that is in quantum superpositions. And these are weak measurements on this quantum superposition. And this will be the way to see how we can measure properties, interesting properties, on ensemble of particles connected with what I call weak values. And that is now what I'm going to introduce, because that is the next interesting aspect of what happened in quantum mechanics. So I have shown that we can measure, for example, if we have an ensemble of particles, all of them described by the same state, I have shown that I can take any sum of operators, individual operators, an divided by n, and I will get the answer, a average, when I do a measurement on this ensemble. But this measurement doesn't disturb any of the individual particles, because it leaves the ensemble unchanged. So therefore, I can, after I finish this experiment, come and do a strong measurement on each one of these particles and find out the post-selection. And something very interesting happened in this case, and I can introduce it in two different ways. Here's the first way to introduce it. And I give the credit for this first way to Sandu Popescu, who was working with me on his PhD on this thing, and he came with this idea. He said the following: look, if I look at the average psi, a psi, I can now introduce a complete set of functions and write the following thing: sum over n, psi, phi n, phi n, a psi. And because I added here a sum over a complete set of vectors, this is a unit operator. You know that sum is a unit operator, so I'm allowed to introduce it here. And then I can do another trick. I can divide by phi n psi and multiply by phi n psi. Let me assume that none of them is equal to zero. My complete set of functions, none of them is exactly orthogonal to psi, so I'm allowed to do it in general. A part of set of measure zero of any selection that will work. Now, this thing, together with this thing, is the probability to find to start with psi and find phi n provided I denotate psi. Now my Lewis measurement denotates psi. So therefore, I can say that I interpret, this is still A average, I can now interpret A average not as something that each particle produces, but in fact, I would say each particle that is pre-selected by psi and post-selected by phi n produces this answer, this shift to the measuring device, with this value that we call weak value. And the A average comes from the number of times that we get this weak value and the number of times that we get the other weak value, and the sum of all of this gives us the usual A average. So that suggests, that idea suggests something extremely interesting, namely that if I start with a state psi, this is time, and if I postulate a state phi n, this is one possibility out of all the possible results of final measurement. Then if I measure weakly A in the middle for this situation, I will find not A average and not one of the eigenvalues of A, but I will find this mysterious value, which I write separately again, it's so important. I will find in such a measurement, if I have a measuring device that interacts weakly with a single particle that was pre-selected this way and post-selected this way, and the coupling is proportional to A, the point of the measuring device will shift not by A average, but will shift by this new value, which is phi n A psi divided by phi n psi. So what it means really, if you want to see a picture, if I have a pointer of a measuring device which is described by some thing, this is the wave function of the measuring device, this is the spread of the pointer. A strong measurement says that the pointer moves by a distance proportional to what I measure, distance much bigger than the uncertainty. That is a strong measurement. I look at what happened to the measuring device, I know what was the value that I measured. But suppose that the shift is very, very small compared to the uncertainty. So I have a shift that is very small compared to the uncertainty because the coupling is very, very weak. So the shift is proportional to the coupling strength. Now the question is, what is the size of this shift? Before we thought that this size is A average. But no, it turns out that if I do a pre and post selection, that shift will be this eigenvalue, this weak value. And I cannot see it on a single particle, I have to come and measure it on many, many repeated experiments many times. I will see that indeed, when I collect many, many results, all of them from the cases when I started with psi and then ended with phi n, I find that what all these measuring devices saw was this value. So for example, if we have the first article that we wrote about weak measurements was how could the measurement of spin half particle give us the result 100, where the maximum is just 1/2. We wrote this very provocative name of this article. And we can see how the weak value can give you this answer. Suppose I start with an eigenstate of sigma z cosine theta plus sigma e sine theta is equal to 1. I start with an eigenstate of this operator. And suppose I do the post-selection on the state sigma z cosine theta minus sigma e sine theta is equal to 1. Okay, this is the post-selection. Now, a theorem. If I have a pre and post-selection psi, and I have here an operator A1 plus A2 times phi, and I divide by 5 psi. If psi is a negative set of A2 and phi is a negative set of A1, then the answer will be A1 weak plus A2 weak, right? Because when A2 acts on psi, it will give me the number, the eigenvalue, and when A1 acts on this, it will be the eigenvalue. So the weak value will be the sum of the eigenvalues here and here. So if I have pre and post selection like this, that means that I know that the sum of these two, the weak value of the sum of these two will be equal to 2. Because this is the negative value of this negative value. This cancels that. That means that 2 sigma z cosine theta will be equal to 2. And therefore, sigma z weak will be equal to 1 over cosine theta. And if cosine theta is sufficiently small, I can get 100. So I can do a pre and post selection on, say, magnetic moment of a neutron. I do, take a neutron, I do pre and post selection on its spin. The pre-selection finds the spin positive in this direction. The post-selection finds the spin positive in this direction. Then the weak value in between is equal to 100. How am I going to see it? So I don't have to do any work at all. Nature does it for me. Because if I have here a magnetic moment sitting here, and I look at the magnetic field that is produced everywhere else, I make definite measurement of the magnetic field here. The magnetic field that I measure will be the magnetic field of the vacuum shifted by the magnetic field, by this magnetic field. The magnetic field uncertainty of the magnetic field of the vacuum will be very large compared to what the magnetic moment produces. And we know that because we know that we can do interference experiments with Newton, we don't destroy the coherence. But if we now repeat, we make measurements of the magnetic field any place here. From one of them, I don't find any information at all. But I do this experiment many times and collect only the times, only the results for which I got this pre and post selection. Lo and behold, I will find that indeed this magnetic moment behaves as a magnetic moment 100 times as much. And nature gives me for free these weak measurements. All the time, these weak measurements happen. So not only the macroscopic limit, the way that I discussed before, but even when I do experiment, interference experiment or any other experiment where I have pre and post selection on microscopic particles, I don't have to do any very careful measurement by weak coupling. Automatically, nature does it for me. Then I go and strongly measure the magnetic field everywhere. When I do this strong measurement of the magnetic field anywhere, I will find essentially vacuum fluctuation slightly shifted. But I collect enough repetition for the correct pre and post selection, and lo and behold, I would find that indeed, I would find indeed this magnetic moment affected all the other world as if it was 100 times bigger if I have this pre and post selection. Okay? So people that try to attempt in some artificial way to do artificial measurement that will get by mistake this thing, that's stupid, because nature does it for us as a physical true thing. The thing acts in all respects like a magnetic moment that's 100 times bigger, provided it interacts with the rest of the universe weakly. As long as it interacts weakly with the rest of the universe, when we have this pre and post selection, automatically it will, the rest of the universe will see that behavior. It has nothing to do with measurement. It's a way, universal way, how each particle, quantum particle that has pre and post selection, automatically affects the rest of the universe this way. Okay, this is very important, so I want you to ask questions about it, see if you understand what I'm saying. Or maybe before that, let me prove to you. Here I said, I guess that that is correct. Let me now prove that indeed, if the weak, if the coupling is weak, the measuring device will act in this way. So how do I do that? If I look at the time translation operator when I have a measurement, if I have an interaction between measuring device and the system, which is Q for the measuring device times A for the system. and I put here some G, G of T. This is the way that von Neumann discusses quantum theory of measurement. He imitated, he generalized what happens when we do a Stern-Gerlach experiment. When we do a Stern-Gerlach experiment, we have here a region of space where we have in this direction an inhomogeneous magnetic field BZ that's equal to Z times some number. So if a particle, an atom, for example, comes here, it gets its interaction with the magnetic field is mu for the magnetic moment times sigma z of the electron distance of the atom times z times b0. So when you have a coupling like this, you see that the particle that moves here feels a constant force which is proportional to the value of sigma z, because the derivative of this is the change in the momentum. So when the electron, the atom comes here, gets a kick either in this direction or in this direction, which tells you whether the spin is up or the spin is down. The kick is because it got a momentum in this direction proportional to the spin. Now, a strong experiment is an experiment which is the following. We know that because the atom is in this region, it has some uncertainty in its momentum in the direction. So if the shift, if the inhomogeneous magnetic field is sufficiently strong, the change in momentum is large compared to this uncertainty, and therefore it will really split into moving up or moving down. But if I have a very weak inhomogeneous magnetic field, then the uncertain momentum will shift just slightly up or slightly down. So the two blobs that will come out will be practically overlapping. So for a single case, I will not know what was the spin or what was the size of the spin. But if I repeat this experiment many, many times, then if I collect, for example, if I do pre-selection where I've selected the spin in the east direction, so it was a superposition of spin up and spin down in the z direction. And if before I come to a photographic plate, I put here something that let only particles with spin in some other direction go through. That will be the post-selection. If I only collect those and then see what happens when I collect them on a photographic plate, I will see that this blob that before shifted only by a very, very small amount, it will be shifted now by 100 times the small amount. It will still be smaller than the uncertainty principle, but it will be much more prominent. And that is the trick how you do weak measurements using weak values that are amplifications. And we can see that you can generalize this to any kind of measurement, and that is what von Neumann suggested. He said, if you want to measure any observable, introduce a coupling to a pointer. The pointer here was the center of mass of the atom. That was the pointer. The thing that the position of the center of the atom has momentum and position. And then, so the position of the point of the atom and its velocity was the pointer, and the spin was the thing that I want to measure. I can't directly look at the spin, so I first correlate the spin to the pointer, which is that motion, and then I can amplify that motion because I can amplify the position later. So that's the trick of how to do a measurement recognition for Neumann. By the way, people think that this is a very restricted kind of description of interaction. Why would you have this linear interaction to the pointer? It turns out that this is the most general coupling that exists in nature, because the coupling to the electromagnetic field is linear in the electromagnetic modes. So this coupling is extremely important. It's not only convenient to write it this way, but the interaction of charge with any electromagnetic mode is linear in the variables of the electromagnetic mode, and therefore this is a very general coupling. So we say then that if we look at what happens, for example, to the magnetic field when I have here a magnetic moment, or if I do all kinds of other post-selection, we'll do many, many more interesting examples later, we see that it's very important that nature does for us weak measurements all the time, all the time. In the macroscopic world, it's done in the classical limit because of these many, many particles. And in the case of the electromagnetic case, we have now all the degrees of freedom of the electromagnetic field. Each one of them has its zero fluctuations. And therefore, it measures the electromagnetic field, measures all the time, weekly, any charged particle is moving. And if I have just a neutral particle, it's the gravitational field that does it for us. If I have neutral, it's the magnetic moment, so it's again the electromagnetic field that does it. So nature does for us all the time with measurement. This is the most common thing that happens. It's not only measurement, the interaction is in the sense measurement. And what we see in this measurement, when we collect the right pre and post electron ensemble, is this new kind of property. It's a property of each individual particle. It's a property that is the weak value, and let me write it again. I have a post-selection, I have an observable, I have a pre-selection, and I divide it by 5 psi, and I say this is indeed a true property of quantum systems that I can measure, provided I don't disturb it, so it has to be weak measurement. I can find out that each quantum system that is pre and post selected has this new kind of properties. Very special example of these properties is if phi is equal to psi, the weak value is just the average. If phi or psi are eigenstate of A, the weak value is the eigenvalue. But in general, it could be something very, very new. In particular, this function is not even real. It's complex. What does it mean that we measure something that is a complex number? In classical physics, it has no meaning at all. Quantum mechanics teaches, taught me how to understand what it means. Suppose I say that I have a wave function which is equal to minus p squared over 2m, over delta squared, delta p squared, 2 delta p squared. And now suppose I say that that pointer was shifted by an imaginary value, not by real value, but by imaginary value. So that means that it went into e to the minus p plus ip0 squared over 2 delta squared. The momentum was shifted by the weak value, and the weak value was imaginary, not real. Does it have a meaning? The answer is yes, because this is still a vector in Hilbert space. And what is the meaning of this vector? Remember that normalization always has to be taken care of separately because I do post-selection. So don't worry about normalization. But look what this is. This is the original e to the minus p squared over 2 delta squared. Then I have the term e to the minus IPP0 over delta squared, and then that's the normalization factor, e to the minus, e to the plus P0 squared. This is the original thing, and most, this is just normalization, forget about it. What is the meaning of that? The meaning of that is a shift, not in the momentum, but in the position. So when I make weak measurement and find a complex number, the real part of the number tells me how the pointer was shifted, and the imaginary part of it tells me how it's how the conjugate was moving. Okay, so this is a beautiful thing. And we'll see how to understand the conservation law of the imaginary thing would be very interesting thing to see how it works next time. So, I'm nearly ready to stop today. I'm a little bit tired. So, we have the following. We have. So, let me summarize. We discover two types of measurements that don't change quantum systems. One is measurements that measure deterministic operators. Those measurements can be as strong as we like, and they find something without collapse, without disturbing the system, but they are very limited. They are, for each vector inverse space, only very special ones are allowed to be called properties of such individual system. But when we come to a large collection of particles, or repetition many times on the same particle, which is the same thing, we suddenly find that there is very, very broad class of measurement that can be done, provided the interaction with each system is very weak. There will still be measurement that measure properties, but the properties now are of the ensemble, not of the individual one. And what does it mean to say that ensemble of particles have properties that cannot be connected trivially to each one of them individually? Okay? For that, I will just remind you about a situation in classical physics that we are all familiar with, and that will be the end of this talk today. In classical physics, we have the following situation. Suppose I have a cavity, and I keep the walls of the cavity at temperature T. Okay? And suppose in the cavity I have many, many atoms, and the system is in equilibrium. If the system is in equilibrium, I know that I can look now at thermodynamic properties of macroscopic densities, for example, whose function is a function of position, for example, is the Boltzmann distribution, that if you have a potential V of R, then the probability to find the density here is e to the minus V of R divided by Kt. So I have here a function that I can measure when I have an ensemble, many, many particles, but it's certainly not a property of each individual particle. Each individual particle, that's the point. But the whole ensemble has this property suddenly. So it's a property of the ensemble that cannot be directly connected to each individual particle, physically. Now, but suppose now I have just a single particle here. Just a single particle. But I wait a long time. This single particle will, it goes a straight line each time. Okay, it goes a straight line here. It won't hit the wall here yet because it gets hit by some atoms in the wall, it goes other directions. Then if I wait a long time and ask how much time did the particle spend at each small region, if the time is sufficiently long, it exactly this function. So suddenly I see that an individual particle, I can find the same information provided I do an experiment that lasts a very long time. Now, when I still believed in the wave function, before I knew that I have to kill it, I invented a measurement that I call protective measurement. And this measurement I have shown, with the help of Lev Eilman, I have shown the following. That if you have, for example, an electron in hydrogen atom in the ground state, so we know that its wave function has a shape like this. This shape has infinite number of information. What is that? Size at each point of space. Can we see that information of the single particle? And the answer is yes, because I invented the idea that if I come with measuring device, interact with the particle only here, but do the interaction in such a way that I don't give enough energy to excite the electron. So the electron will all the time stay in this state. And the question is, what value will I see at the end? Turns out that the value that we see at the end is exactly the size of this wave function. So I call this protective measurement and say that, we can measure an individual wave function for individual electron. But then it turns out, as I will show you next time, that this is misleading. Because in the Schrödinger picture we say the wave function remains all the time the same, and therefore this, what I looked about here, was constant, and therefore I saw really at each instant of time exactly this size. But now, if we look at the Heisenberg representation, we find that what we measure here is a projection operator on this state, it is time dependent. And we can see this time dependent in another way, that after I finish this very long experiment, because I did not change the wave function, I can do now a post-selection that will be such that it will post-select another state that will oscillate back and forth. And then I will show that indeed what I measure here is time average. How long that really the passage is. So it's not a constant, it's again a time average. So measurement of the scissor particle, just a very long time, can give you information that doesn't stick on the particle at each individual time. Mm-hmm. That is enough for today. Okay? Thank you.
Quick question regarding this. You were talking about single particle in a box at temperature T.
Yeah.
How do you actually define the Fermanagh quantum? How do you define temperature for just one particle?
No, the temperature is the world.
Okay, that was just in the back.
Yeah,
okay.
The everything is world at temperature T, and a single particle is just longer than T.
Okay.
And then how long is
the well, I have this especially just for single particle.
I disagree with
that. No.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
You don't mind.